in this recording, I'm going to be relying on chapter 4 of Wenham's book, which is called Building a Synoptic Theory, Part 3, The Relation of Matthew to Mark. And we're going to follow this, I've said, because this book is hard to get hold of. I wish you can get hold of Redating Matthew, Mark, and Luke by John Wenham. But when I checked its availability on Amazon, the copies were over $100. Now, if you can find it for cheaper than that, buy it and study it. You may be able to get lucky that way. It seems as though I did, because I bought mine for $7. So, persevere on that. But of course, the key, really, this issue is the relation of Matthew to Mark. Stein's arguments very often have to do with, well, if Mark copied from Matthew, then why did he not include all of this great material? The Sermon on the Mount has given us an example. Or, if Matthew didn't use Mark, then how do we account for his use of the conjunction gar, for, in those places where he seems to be, or at least he has in common with Mark? It's easier to explain those if he's copying from Mark. And so how do we deal with these issues? Well, following Wenham here, we're going to track through this whole issue. On page 89, we have, first of all, the account by the classical scholar Rist, R-I-S-T. Now, Rist believes that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are independent. Neither Wenham nor I believe that they are independent, but that Rist's researchers do show that there is a large amount of independence between the sources, and that there is a larger amount of at least independent source material that these evangelists have, and a fairly small amount of dependence. As we've reported, Luke is depending on the order of Mark, but not on the content of Mark. And so we quote here on page 89. Rist examines many of the parallel passages in detail and concludes that it is difficult to find rational grounds for the supposed redaction either of Mark by Matthew or of Matthew by Mark. He summarizes part of his argument thus, quote, "Sometimes the theory that Matthew depends on Mark entails extraordinary carelessness on the part of Matthew. Sometimes the theory that Mark depends on Matthew entails extraordinarily unlikely genesis for the brilliant and graphic Markan narrative." Rist certainly makes a strong case for a large measure of independence in the case of the two Gospels, based on the evidence of a huge number of differences between them in parallel passages. But when he goes on to argue total literary independence, he is unconvincing. Great sections of the two Gospels have the pericopes in the same order. The identity of order is almost complete in the last half of Matthew, from 14:1 onwards, and the last two-thirds of Mark, from 6:14. And thus provides evidence of some literary connection between them. Now he continues. "One achievement of the modern reopening of the synoptic debate by Butler, Farmer, and the rest has been the recognition of the worthlessness of so many of the arguments which have been deployed. Most of the arguments are reversible and can be used with comparable effectiveness either way. So often reasons purporting to support a given redactional view are simply possible reasons which might have influenced a redactor if there was a redactor, which is yet to be proved." I quoted that last time, but it bears rehearsing here. Now, he talks about Edwin A. Abbott's illustration here of how Markan priority can be proven. And Abbott has this rather amusing illustration. Quote, this is Wenham quoting Edwin A. Abbott. Matthew and Luke are in the position of two schoolboys, Primus and Tertius, seated on the same form, between whom sits another, Secundus, Mark. All three are writing, we will suppose, a narrative of the same event. Primus and Tertius copy largely from Secundus. Occasionally, the two copy the same words. Then we have agreement of three writers. At other times, Primus, Matthew, copies what Tertius, Luke, does not. At others, Tertius, Luke, copies what Primus, Matthew, does not. But you see, what he's trying to say is that they're both copying from Secundus, from Mark. He goes on, Wenham says, to show that since Primus and Tertius cannot see each other's work, agreement of any importance against Secundus will be non-existent. But, as the same results would follow if Secundus copied from Primus and was himself copied by Tertius, one can imagine the indignation of an innocent Primus if he was summoned to the headmaster's study and falsely accused. Now, to put it back into the terms of the synoptic debate, if Luke is copying from Mark and Mark is copying from Matthew, then you cannot accuse Matthew of copying from Mark. After all, Mark can see Matthew's material. When this fallacy has been recognized, he says, all that is left of Streeter's evidence, he has five evidences for Mark and priority in B.H. Streeter's famous book on the four Gospels, all that is left is head number four, which argues the primitive nature of Mark from its use of phrases likely to cause offence and from its roughness of style and its use of Aramaic words. He says, quote, Mark reads like a shorthand account of a story by an impromptu speaker, while Matthew and Luke use the more succinct and carefully chosen language of one who writes and then revises for publication, end quote. That's Wenham quoting Streeter. But he says it is immediately clear that this conclusion in no way conflicts with patristic tradition, which regards Matthew as a carefully prepared written work and Mark as an account based upon the discourses of Peter, which deliberately retains the characteristics of the spoken word. One of the best known defences, Wenham continues, of the old position is that of G.M. Styler in his excursus to C.F.D. Mull's The Birth of the New Testament. Styler's essay in the third edition was written in the light of Butler's and Rist's work. He makes four main points. First, it is difficult to believe that Mark would have omitted so much important Matthean material had he known of its existence. This is exactly what Stein said. Here is Wenham's response. This objection is widely felt and often repeated. But is it not based on a groundless supposition? If it is supposed that Mark was intended as a replacement of Matthew, it has great weight. We should indeed be much the poorer without the great discourses of all Matthew's unique contributions. But whoever suggested that this was the intention? All modern Augustinians, now an Augustinian is somebody who believes that Matthew, Mark, Luke is the order in which the Gospels were written. All modern Augustinians regard Mark as an additional apostolic witness which confirms, illumines, and supplements Matthew, which would have been particularly appreciated by Peter's hearers, as indeed it is by most of us. And then he says this, the supplement is hardly at all that of new incidents and new teaching. It is that of Petrine vividness and Markan emphases, with restriction probably to the most standard elements of the apostles' evangelistic teaching. It is a new portrait. Therefore, this objection that Mark would not have omitted so much Matthew material is a non-objection. In fact, we're going to find out that there is good evidence that Mark is deliberately omitting Matthean material. But the second of Styler's defenses is this. Mark's wealth of detail is a prima facie indication of priority. And again, what have we said? That Mark, according to Stein, he has the more embellished or the longer accounts where the three have the same account. Well, if it's a vivid recollection from Peter, then that basically argues for that. As Wenham says on page 92, Mark is faithfully recording the eyewitness touches of Peter's spoken word. This could have been put on paper just as well after the writing of Matthew as before. So it proves nothing. And then Styler has six key passages which he thinks prove his view. We're not going to go into those, but the most decisive are the death of the Baptist and Pilate's offer to release a prisoner. But these are dealt with very well by Wenham, and if you compare them in the Gospel Harmony, then I think it's pretty easy not to go down the road of Matthean dependence on Mark. It's pretty easy to see them as independent accounts, which do not contradict. And then he says that Matthew, this is his fourth reason, Matthew 27:15 through 18, has destroyed the logic of Mark 15:6 through 10. Well, why don't you look at that and see if that is indeed the case? Wenham says this, "My own view is that in any case the whole discussion of this pericope is beside the point, as there is no firm evidence for a literary connection between the two stories." Now what you need to do, you see, if you hold to the Q hypothesis and Mark and priority, is to show literary dependence of Matthew on Mark in that particular pericope. But if you can't prove it, then the whole argument is destroyed. Wenham says, "In general, I am bound to say that the revised arguments for the priority of Mark seem to give every encouragement to those who incline towards the priority of Matthew." And now we're going to look at Wenham's arguments for Matthean priority. And I think, by the way, just before I go through these, some of these are going to strike you, I believe, as just obvious, if you know the Gospels at all. Here's the first one. Matthew looks original. And I think this strikes any reader of Matthew's Gospel. Matthew does look original. It's very Jewish in its content. He claims to be, or at least has views there, that seem to be eyewitness accounts in the details that he records and so on. Wenham says this under this head, "As the title of this book suggests, the originality of Matthew particularly struck Butler, as it had done Jameson and Chapman before him. They were struck by the quality of its composition." Now, nobody can read Matthew's Gospel, and this is what, of course, you should have already done, or what you will be doing. You'll be reading Matthew's Gospel, and it cannot fail to impress you with the quality of its composition. Jameson put it, quote, "The elaborate and well-considered arrangement of the book would be more naturally found in an original composition than in an adaptation from other documents. While the masterly presentation of its subject, implying even an author of unusual skill, is very difficult to account for in a mere compiler who is supposed to have conflated and interwoven these sources in a complicated patchwork of paragraphs and sentences which, like Aaron's calf, have somehow emerged from the process in the shape of a complete and wonderful whole." And Wenham says further on this, "From the earliest patristic times, Matthew's Gospel was held in the very highest esteem. Indeed, it seems to have been regarded as the premier document of the Christian Church, quoted far more than any other Gospel. And it is not exaggerating when Butler calls elements of the book this magnificent composition, his own freely soaring and monumental structure, a stroke of genius. If Matthew is indeed following Mark, his many departures from his text are cleverly disguised, and it is surprising that he has obliterated so much of Mark's vivid narrative. So Matthew looks original. Second reason for holding Matthew in priority. Matthew looks early and Palestinian. Wenham, for example, says that Christianity was at its beginnings a wholly Jewish movement, and it seems natural that the gospel most evidently designed for Jewish readers should be early. Matthew has an apologetic showing that Jesus was the Messiah. Look at 1:1, 1:17, 2:4, 16:16, 26:68, 27:22. Hence, it constantly appeals to the fulfillment of the scriptures. Matthew shows the sharpness of the conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees. Now, this would have been, as Wenham points out, something that would have been particularly of interest to the early Jewish church, wouldn't it? Because they're trying to sort through the differences between the two teachings. Then he says, Matthew's account looks like a vivid record of a terrible clash between Jesus and the religious leaders, rather than a veiled polemic of church against synagogue, which of course it would have been if Matthew is writing a lot later. Some of the apologetic, for example, the account of the suicide of Judas and the account of the guard at the tomb, seems of no great theological significance, yet of particular interest to those who frequented Jerusalem. His third reason for Matthew's early date. Mark looks like Peter's version of the same Palestinian tradition composed for Jewish and Gentile readers outside Palestine. Now let me just include here, if you haven't got it already. If Mark is Peter's account, that accounts for the Aramaisms that those people that believe in Mark and priority keep pointing to as a reason for Mark and priority. These are Peter's Aramaisms, and Peter is a Jew, and so that's of little consequence. Well, under this head, he says, page 96, we have already noted Streeter's judgment that, quote, Mark reads like a shorthand account of a story by an impromptu speaker, end quote. This is certainly the impression gained by many readers. Although Mark is not bad Greek, it is very informal, unliterary sort of Greek, such as one might expect from an oral discourse. He eschews almost entirely the periods beloved of the great prose writers, preferring parataxis and the frequent use of chi. His addition of euthus, straight away or immediately, and the historic present, the number of anacoluthae and parentheses, his fondness for vivid detail, his tautological expressions, all comport well with the picture of a dynamic speaker. It is, of course, possible that all these characteristics are the product of lively traditional material worked up by the author's literary skill. But the patristic tradition of its Petrine origin is a simpler hypothesis, and it gives greater credit to Mark as one anxious to hand on the apostolic teaching faithfully. In other words, we don't need to say that, well, Mark, you know, he derives his vividness from his own abilities and his own handling of materials that he's using. We just need to say that Mark gets his vividness from Peter, and that Mark is faithfully writing down and compiling what Peter had written, and this accounts for his quote-unquote poor Greek, and for the redundancies, and for the Aramaisms, and for the expansions where the three Gospels agree. It also says that Mark is not interested in editing anything. He's just reporting faithfully. And Wenham quotes the German scholar Stolt, who also disagrees with Mark and Priority. Thus, one would have every right to expect that the figure of Peter would not only take a central position in the Gospel of Mark, but also, beyond that, would stand out considerably more than in any other of the Gospels. This, however, is not the case. On the contrary, the following important passages, which refer to Peter in the two parallel texts, have no equivalent in Mark. Now, we're going to show where this is leading in a minute. Matthew 14:28-31, where Simon walks on the water, sinks, and is rescued by Jesus. Matthew 16:17-20, Simon's beatitude, the bestowal of the name Peter and the granting of the keys. Matthew 17:14-27, the questioning of Simon by the tax collectors as to whether Jesus paid the half-shekel tax Jesus charged to Peter and the shekel in the fish's mouth. Matthew 18:21-22, Peter's question about how often one should grant forgiveness. And then in the Luke's account, Luke 5:3-10, Peter's miraculous catch of fish and his saying, "Depart from me, for I'm a sinful man." Luke 22:31-32, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith shall not fail, and when you have turned again, or been converted, strengthen your brethren." Luke 22:8, in order to prepare the Passover feast, Jesus sends out Peter and John, whereas Mark just has two of his disciples. Now, what we're pointing to here, or what Stolt is pointing to, is the fact that where you would expect, perhaps at first blush anyway, that if Mark is Peter's account, then Peter is going to include himself and include details of himself, he actually doesn't. These details are found in these passages in Matthew and Luke. How do we account for this? Well, I think it's very easy to account for this fact by the fact that Peter does not want to call attention to himself. As Butler puts it, Mark contains all that the Gospels tell us in disparagement of Peter: that he rebuked our Lord at Caesarea Philippi and was rebuked by him, that he presumed to promise loyalty, though all others should fail, and yet alone, in set terms, denied him. In telling the Caesarea Philippi incident, he has, in that case, torn out of the story the high praise of himself and the promise of his peculiar status vis-a-vis the church, while leaving the stinging rebuke. And again, he has omitted the incident of the temple tribute, which seems to put him in a peculiarly close relation to his master, and that of his walking on the waters. Ought we to wonder that the Prince of the Apostles had learned the lesson of Christian humility well enough to lay bare not only his strength, but his weaknesses? In this, you see, it seems as though by reporting Peter's accounts, and yet showing Peter's blemishes, and yet leaving out the accounts in Matthew and Luke, which seem to give a promotion or give a better account to Peter, then this is just what you would expect from an apostle who has been humbled by these incidents that are recorded in Mark's Gospel. So that's another reason for believing that Matthew wrote before Mark, because on this explanation, all we have is just Peter's account of what Matthew has already recorded, but in less honorific terms. The next reason that Wenham gives for preferring Matthean priority is, it looks as though Mark is omitting Matthean material at certain points. And this I found particularly helpful. And I wish I could give you more of the material than I can, but I'm going to try and quote and sum up what I can here with what 1M says. He says, "It was this observation which precipitated Chapman into his repudiation of the two-document theory. In his Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he told of his rather dogmatic and vocal commitment to the standard theory and of his disappointment when the Pontifical Biblical Commission," Chapman was a Roman Catholic, "in 1911 and 1912, ruled against it and in favor of the Augustinian order. He set about trying to disprove the commission's case." And so Wenham is going to refer to Chapman's attempts to disprove the Matthean priority, and he said this: "If Mark abbreviated Matthew, omitting much, adding next to nothing, since Mark is carelessly written with less literary ability than the other Gospels, wherever it makes long omissions, we shall find some sign of the gap. Perhaps merely want of sequence, for Matthew is very systematic, or even illogical sequence. If there are no such signs, and there cannot well be, since nobody has noticed them, I shall conclude quite securely that Mark is indeed prior to Matthew." Now, this was Chapman's working hypothesis. Maybe I should repeat that. Chapman's beginning hypothesis was this: if Mark abbreviated Matthew, omitting much, adding next to nothing, since Mark is carelessly written with less literary ability than the other Gospels, wherever it makes long omissions, we shall find some sign of the gap. Perhaps merely want of sequence, for Matthew is very systematic, or even illogical sequence. If there are no such signs, and there cannot well be, since nobody has noticed them, I shall conclude quite securely that Mark is indeed prior to Matthew. Here was a practical test, and I applied it at once. I started with Mark 4:1, which is a parallel to Matthew 13:1, where our Lord teaches from a boat. St. Matthew gives a series of parables and the explanations given in private to the disciples of two of them. 1, the sower. 2, the disciples ask for an explanation. 3, a prophecy of Isaiah and blessings on those who see and hear. 4, explanation of the sower. 5, wheat and the tares. 6, the mustard seed. 7, the leaven. 8, all this was said in parables. 9, to fulfill a prophecy of Psalm 78:2. 10, then indoors in the house, the explanation of wheat and tares. 11, the hidden treasure. 12, the merchant and the pearl. 13, the dragnet of fishes. 14, the final verse, things old and new. Of all this, Mark gives 1, 2, 4, 6, and 8. And he interpolates 4 quasi-proverbial verses, which are found elsewhere in Matthew, and a short parable peculiar to himself. Therefore, Mark has 3 parables and 1 explanation against the 7 parables and 2 explanations of Matthew. Does Mark show any sign of having omitted anything? Chapman says he does, on 2 occasions. And then he compares Matthew 13:3 with Mark 4:2. And Matthew 13:34 with Mark 4:33 and 34. And he says, here St. Matthew sums up tauta panta, but Mark of necessity changes this to poieta pola. And because Matthew is about to add the explanation of a parable, which Mark had omitted, the latter supplies its place by the general statement that, in private, Matthew 13:36, or in the house, Christ explained all the parables to his disciples. Now, here's the main point, if you don't get all of that I've just said. I wonder whether the reader can imagine my surprise on lighting upon these two omissions by Mark of Matthean material. In other words, these two disproofs of his working hypothesis. I had proposed a test and I was already answered. I had imagined, I suppose, some illogical sequence at most, and I expected to find nothing at all, and I found apparently two definite statements by Mark that he had omitted some outdoor parables and indoor explanations. This was astounding. I did not wait. I went on in haste to another passage. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 19, contains a long discourse of Christ against the Pharisees and the scribes, ending with an appeal to Jerusalem, which had slain the prophets, if you remember that. Of these 38 verses, 2 through 39, Mark has 2.5 only, very freely and pointedly given. The chapter was of great importance in Palestine, but at Rome it was valueless, except as a moral lesson against vanity and ambition. Now let us see how it is introduced. And so, looking at Matthew 23:1, comparing that with Mark 12:38, and he shows here that Mark tells us once more, in the course of his teaching, he was saying. What teaching? Look at Matthew. There it is, shoals of it, that whole account. Again, what Chapman had found is that Mark is omitting Matthean material. He's omitting Matthew 23, but he is at least mentioning that his account is in the midst of that teaching. Going back to Wenham, all this does seem to suggest that Mark is conscious of omitting material at these points. Chapman argues that the didrachma incident also looks more like an omission by Mark than an addition by Matthew. And you can compare Matthew 17, 22 and 23 with Mark 9, 30, 32. And also with Luke 9:43-45. This is where you need your harmony. Where Matthew and Mark march together in the usual manner, Matthew interpolates the story of the didrachma and the stater in the fish's mouth, after which again the three Gospels agree. Going back to what Wenham says and comment on this, it may in general be said that, although Mark looks like Peter's version of it, Mark and Matthew are basically the same tradition, something which cannot be said if either are compared with Luke or John. If Acts is to be believed, Peter was the leading figure in the early Jerusalem church and doubtless played a large part in molding the form of the teaching given to those who flocked to the city from all over the world. Presumably, there was a core of instruction which had been carefully rehearsed by the 12 and the 70 before they went out telling the words and deeds of Jesus. To this would have been added later incidents, particularly emphasizing the Passion and Resurrection. If Matthew was the first approved record of this teaching, it is natural that it should be strong in its Jewish and Palestinian matter, with stress on messiahship, the fulfillment of prophecy, and Jesus' conflict with the Pharisees. When this tradition was taken to a Gentile environment, one would expect to see a great reduction in the Jewish emphasis, and one would expect something very like Mark to be the staple content of Peter's instruction. One would expect to see Mark, true to the sense of Matthew, with here and there additional details and clarifications. And this is very much what we appear to have. Mark gives, for instance, a fuller and clearer account of the death of the Baptist. Compare Matthew 14:3-12 with Mark 6:17-29. And he provides explanations of things Jewish, which Matthew's original hearers would not have needed. for example, the Mount of Olives, the Passover being killed. If you look in Mark 7:3, Mark 13:3, and Mark 15:42, we have those kinds of explanations. And so, summarizing that long account, all we're trying to say, and we tried to quote you quite a lot of Chapman's material here, because again, it's hard to get hold of this material. But the summary is simply this. Chapman tried to find areas where Mark would have omitted from Matthew. And he didn't expect to find any. But in fact, he's found three very clear ones. And in doing that, he said that shocked him, because that should not have been the case if Mark wrote first. But these very clear indications that Mark is omitting deliberately material that is found in Matthew's gospel shows that Matthew wrote first. When you bring into account also the fact that, as we've said, Matthew emphasizes messiahship, the fulfillment of prophecy, the stinging conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees, things that would have been very important to a Palestinian audience but not to a Roman audience, then this helps us to see that the case for Matthew in priority is greatly bolstered.